OEA, the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, on session.
Good morning, y'all can be seated, thank you. All right, well, welcome to the Third Court of Appeals, folks. Also, welcome Westlake High School, it's a pleasure to have you here as well today. Justice Kelly and Justice Ellis and I are thrilled to have you here today for this argument. This is cause number 0324282 CV, New Braunfels Stewart Properties and Harold Ray versus Circle F Investments LP and Original DFI LLC. If I can have counsels introduce themselves and announce ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Michael Morris. I represent New Braunfels Stewardship Property and Mr. Leslie Ray.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. TJ Turner and Ben Evans on behalf of the appellees. We are ready.
All right, welcome. Gentlemen, as you probably know, we have this very highly sophisticated timekeeping machine here. And you know that green says that you can go, yellow means you've got two more minutes, and red means you need to stop. I understand you will start, Mr. Morris, at 12 minutes, 20 minutes on this side, and then 8 in reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. And also, just so you know, we are live broadcasting this on our YouTube channel. So you can send a link later to your friends and family and show them your YouTube presentation if you so desire. We did receive from each side, we received the appellant's submissions. We received the appellee's objections. We are not going to deal with objections today or anything. This court knows what's in and what's out of the record, so we're just going to proceed. We only have such a short amount of time. We'll just proceed to the heart of the matter, and I think you might be expecting and should expect quite a few questions today. So let me turn the floor over to you, Mr. Morris. You may proceed.
May it please the court.
Yes,
counsel. In 2017, Mr. Flack approached New Braunfels Stewardship asking to lease two metal warehouses on their dilapidated hardscrabble property in New Braunfels, Texas. The four friends of New Braunfels Stewardship that had scraped together their nickels to buy the warehouse space agreed to rent these to Mr. Flack, who put the leases in the name of his two LLCs, ODFI and Circle. In 2019, the owners, New Braunfels Stewardship, evicted Mr. Flack and his LLCs from the property. Mr. Flack appealed to the county court at law after losing the eviction hearing at the Justice of the Peace. In 2022, Comal County Court of Law jury heard 3 days of testimony on the eviction appeal and unanimously found that Circle LLC had breached the lease on the back building and that ODFI had breached the lease on the front building. This is tab number 9 in your binders. Mr. Flack again appealed that eviction to this court and cause number 0322-00696. And on October 29th, 2024, Justices Baker, Triana, and Smith affirmed the eviction. This is tab number 8 in your binders. In the meantime, Mr. Flack filed this occasion in Comal County District Court for wrongful eviction. Case went to trial in December 2023, and a new jury, hearing only half the story and half the evidence, awarded $2 million breach of lease to ODFI, $2 million breach of lease to Circle, $1 million to Circle for fraud claims, $2 million in unjust enrichment, and $600,000 in attorney fees, for a grand total of $7.6 million, or $1.2 million more than Mr. Flack's pie-in-the-sky request that he asked of the jury. We tried to explain the gross inequity of these duplicitous and unfounded results, and the trial judge replied, "That is why the Court of Appeals is there, to sort this out." So where do we begin?
Mr. Morris, what legal theory is your sufficiency argument based on? Is it legal sufficiency, factual sufficiency?
Thank you, Jessica. It's based on both of those, actually. A couple of the issues that we're dealing with here, there's clear showings that there is no evidence to support the lost profits calculation, because the lost profits calculation has to be based on credible evidence. And without that credible evidence, there's no evidence. But it's also a factual sufficiency question, because the amount of evidence coming into it, again, isn't enough to support what he's doing. He's got gaps in between many of his items on there, and those aren't sufficient to support his judgment either.
I'm going to dive pretty deep here, Mr. Morris.
Yes, Justice.
The way I see this is your summary judgment argument first. If you went on summary judgment, I see this as a remand and a new trial. Then your lost profits argument on the breach of contract, I see that as the next big beast to deal with. And if you win on that, let's say we agree, then we get to unjust enrichment and fraud. And in between there, you've got the one satisfaction rule on whether you could have both. Let's imagine that you win on lost profits here at this court, and now we're stuck with unjust enrichment and fraud. And let's assume for a brief moment that we believe that there's some evidence, there's legally and factually sufficient evidence on those bases, on fraud and unjust enrichment. And let's put Mr. Ray out for the moment, just the entity. What are the damages if that is the case?
If according to what you're proposing, the breach of contract case has been removed and there are no ability to bring that back, because that would mean this court had reversed and rendered on those issues, and so therefore those would be gone. He would then have the question of what would be the damages naturally procuring from a claim of fraud. Of course, we have very little evidence of that fraud, and none, as far as I'm concerned, that is sufficient to justify it.
And is it fraud or fraudulent inducement, or both?
Well, they never submitted fraud by admission to the jury, and they never submitted fraudulent inducement to the jury. They only submitted common law fraud. I don't know if we were remanding for a new trial, if that would be the same. But let's take, for example, just that first issue of common law fraud. The fraud they're complaining of occurred, I think, on December 28th of 2018. In which they have a statement by Mr. Hickman, who's passed away. His son is here, Mr. Jim Hickman. But Mr. Hickman says, come on, let's do this. We'll get you, if parking lot holds you up, we're gonna give you $5,000 a month, some sort of damages. That would be the argument over that $5,000 a month, and that would be the natural damages he would incur from that. The dispute would be, was it contingent on us holding him up or not? The other fraud they complain about and is presented to the trial court, that fraud was there some sort of argument that the wrongful stewardship was out of cash? Again, that was made by Mr. Jim Hickman, not Mr. Rusty Ray. How could he rely on the wrongful stewardship saying we're out of cash in January and then spend his money, which had all been spent from 2017 all the way up to January 2019 and say, in reliance on that representation, I spent more money. Well, whatever that more money was would be the measure of fraud for that, as far as I can tell.
Okay. Unjust enrichment?
Unjust enrichment. He invested $240,000 in the back building. Mm-hmm. My clients agreed to invest $25,000 to support him. They ended up spending $80,000, a whole lot more than they anticipated. But that measure of $240,000 that he truly and necessarily invested in that building but never got to enjoy the use of would be his measure of damages. And that's what he argued to the jury. And that's what the evidence showed. It would be $240,000. We've got the breakdown of the $240,000 as Exhibit 6, I think.
So you would agree that there is a potential for, even if the lost profits goes away, which kind of takes away the one satisfaction rule. Mm-hmm. There is a potential for this court finding, there's a potential for this court concluding that there is sufficient evidence for some type of award under unjust enrichment and fraud.
Because I see unjust enrichment and breach of contract as mutually exclusive, if one's gone, I believe the other could exist.
Okay. Gotcha. Thank you for that. Thank you.
When Mr. Flack and ODFI were evicted in 2019, he'd been occupying 2,200 square feet of that 94 square feet front building. But he was going to be a junior landlord. He was going to be the tenant for subtenants. He's never done that before, never had that opportunity before, never been in that business before. So he was going to be subletting that property, and he inquired about how he was going to do his different subtenants in there, and so he approached Papa John's. And Papa John's Pizza gave him a letter of intent, partially executed, and that is the basis for his income to measure for that front building. The problem with that letter of intent, Papa John's was getting the end cap next to the road, the most visibility with a drive-through, the best prime cream of the crop piece of that property. But instead, Mr. Flack just decided, I'm gonna take that $26 per square foot they agreed to and spread it over the entire building. Hopeful, speculative, not based on reasonable certainty.
And your client, if I remember correctly in this record, chose to rely primarily on just cross-examination of those witnesses, attempting to poke holes in their evidence, as opposed to having your own expert witness. Is that correct?
We had experts based on CPA testimony and the examination of the tax records and those kind of things. You're correct. We did not have a real estate commercial expert present at trial.
Okay.
So that unknown quantity of whatever that income would be only had two expenses that Mr. Flack proposed being removed from that. He proposed his rent to the landlord, the owners of the building, New Braunfels Stewardship, and then he proposed the cost of the build out for each of these little tenants. Those were his only two expenses he incurred. But that can't be the case. We know for certain, according to his own testimony and that letter of intent, that there were many more expenses that he would have been involved in, and he needed to take those into consideration. First of all, just the management of advertising space, controlling the space, hiring a broker for the space, the management of all the pieces of property in between and repairs for the common area and non-common area spaces. It's been said in the briefs, I think it's page 9 of Mr. Flack's brief, that these were not triple net leases.
Right.
I would ask you to look at exhibits 1 and 2. Paragraph 6 talks about rent. Paragraph 7 talks about utilities. Paragraph 8 talks about insurance. Paragraph 15 talks about maintenance. All of these were the tenant's responsibility. Both front and back were triple net leases.
May I ask you a question, since I see we have limited time? In your prayer, you have numerous suggestions for how this plays out. In your argument, wherein lies a remand? Under what circumstances would this court remand and grant a new trial? I understand that you want to reverse and render. I get that. That's sure. Your primary thing. But give me your articulated, what would this court have to do to get to a reverse and remand?
If we're doing a remand, I think it's exactly the proposal that you suggested at the beginning. I think if this case is only going to be about fraud and only going to be about how that fraud could possibly be either fraud in the inducement or fraud by omission, which had been pled initially, so I think it's still part of the live pleading, but just not submitted to the jury.
And is disgorgement pled?
Disgorgement was never pled. It was not argued until there was the motion for new trial and the pointing out to the court that, by the way, there's a $2 million judgment when they asked for $241,000. That's when they came up with the novel theory of they're taking the profits from New Braunfels Stewardship that they made. And so that was their argument for disgorgement. But that was the first time it ever appeared.
So that was some kind of motion to enter judgment hearing?
That's correct. That was the motion for new trial, motion to enter judgment followed on the heels of each.
Gotcha. And my apologies. Let me ask my colleagues any questions before. Any questions? All right.
Thank you. We'll
take you up on rebuttal. Thank you. All right. Mr. Turner.
Thank you.
And certainly, Mr. Turner, I would love for you to answer that same question that I asked Mr. Morris about the summary, kind of the waterfall. If I believe that the summary judgment stands and I agree with him that the lost profits are gone, tell me about unjust enrichment and fraud and what your damage argument is, if I think there's sufficient evidence for those two causes of action.
So first of all, may it please the court,
yes, sir.
Counsel, and I would like to start by thanking the court and counsel for accommodating my request to postpone oral argument. I apologize for any inconvenience that may have caused.
I will tell you there was another very eager high school group that wanted to see this oral argument 2 weeks ago, but this wonderful high school group got to see this one today, so hopefully the other high school is watching online today.
Hopefully no harm, no foul, but thank you again to counsel as well.
Absolutely.
Judge, as I understand the question, it is if summary judgment were to stand, if the summary judgments were to stand, but that the court found insufficient evidence of lost profits, such that that would eliminate our breach of contract cause of action, and the only remaining claims would be fraud and unjust enrichment, mm-hmm. What would our damages be in
yes,
that
sir.
Case?
Right.
So the damages.
I mean, I know what the jury said, mm-hmm. but what did you argue to the jury?
So
not motion for new trial to the mm-hmm. jury.
What we argued to the jury and what the jury heard, and counsel is correct, when we gave our summary arguments at court, we pointed most specifically to the money that was spent to improve NBSB's property mm-hmm. by our client and the money that they promised to award, to pay our client if the parking lot was not completed by September of 19, I believe. But we did argue that NBSP should not be able to enjoy the profits that it's realizing now because of the improvements that our client made to their property. Mr. Morris, I don't think he did it on purpose, but he characterized the entire property as dilapidated when our client encountered it, and that's not quite correct. There are three parcels on the property. Two are really at issue here. The front building, what we call the front building, was already built out. And it was already occupied at the time of trial and at the time that Mr. Flack encountered the property. The back building was a dilapidated corrugated metal shed. And what the parties agreed to, the bargain that they struck, was that if NBSP would provide my client with a below market rental rate lease, a long term 20-year mm-hmm. below market rental rate lease, and the express authority to sublease the property, that my client would invest the dollars necessary to bring the back building from a machine shop to a commercial tenant ready building. Mm-hmm. Also, that my client would occupy that back building with his furniture store as the anchor tenant, which is important in commercial real estate, and that my client would manage the property. And in exchange for all of those acts by my client was given the below market rental rate and the ability to sublease that property for the life of the lease. And this is really critical. I know the court has read the briefs, but I want to remind you all just that's what happened here. My client looked at this opportunity as if not a retirement plan, a 20-year investment where he would be able to recoup the costs spent fixing up the client's property by subleasing the property for much more in value than he was paying. My client's leases were at $7 a foot. He had a 20-year lease on each of these properties.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, ma'am, please.
So you put on evidence that for 5 years, you would have a profit of, you put on evidence to the jury of $1.4 million. And then the sublease was going to be another couple of million dollars. The jury found $0 for the subleases, but awarded you $2 million when you put on $1.4 million in evidence. Can you expand on the justification for that additional $600,000 that the jury awarded?
Sure, I certainly can. So keep in mind, again, we have two plaintiffs' appellees. ODFI had the lease on the front building, and they're both owned by Mr. Flack and Mrs. Flack, who are here today. Circle F had the lease on the back building. On the front building, the damages were lost profits for the lost ability to sublease that building for 20 years. And one correction, then I promise I'll get to the question. The Papa John's LOI was at $28 a foot base rent with an additional $3 a foot for common area maintenance. Mr. Flack's lost profits calculation for lost subleases was based on $26 a foot, and that was supported by testimony of our commercial real estate expert that opined on the New Braunfels commercial real estate market. So I want to be clear that it was less than the Papa John's LOI. We accounted for it being on the end cap. But back to your question, the Circle F lease on the back building, what Mr. Flack testified to at trial was that he intended to occupy 6,000 square feet in the back building with his furniture store for 5 years. And that after that first 5 years, he was going to reduce his showroom by 3,000 square feet, cut it in half, and sublease the remaining 3,000 square feet. So the damages on the back building were a combination of both lost furniture sales and lost sublease income from the extra half of the property after he decided to cut it in half. He put on a total of somewhere around, I think, $3.1 million worth of evidence of damages on that back building. The jury, for whatever reason, and it's in the jury's province, did not award any damages for lost subleases. We can speculate that maybe the jury didn't believe Mr. Flack that he was going to cut his showroom in half. But what explains the extra $600,000, and it's actually about $500,000 shy of the total, is if the jury did not award him the lost sublease income on the back building, then they presumed he would be operating his furniture store in the entire 6,000 square feet. Those total damages, if that were the case, would be somewhere around $2.5 million.
But to be clear, that was not the evidence that was presented to the jury. It was a 5-year full 6,000 square feet, and then the sublease, and the jury only gave $2 million for that first, that evidence was not put on, and that goes against what Clay Corr says.
So I understand the question, but what the jury heard from Mr. Flack was the value, the lost profits based on per square foot of his furniture showroom. He testified that he would have that showroom at 6,000 square feet for 5 years and then 3,000 square feet for the remaining 15 years. That resulted in the $1.4 million. So, yes, but no. The jury did hear evidence from Mr. Flack that it could, in a single complete calculation with objective facts, figures, and data, that the jury could have determined how much Mr. Flack would have made in profits from the furniture sales had he elected to keep the 6,000 square feet as his furniture store.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Turner, I just want to shift you for a moment here. Can you clarify what your injury is under your fraud claim and how it did not arise out of an obligation that your clients already had under the contract?
I can, Judge. So the injuries for the fraud claim, and this is another criticism I have of Mr. Morris's statement. The fraud claim was not based on one or two statements that were made in the middle of this relationship among the parties. The fraud claim was based on a number of misrepresentations, probably the most important of which is the entire basis for this deal. So recall that the deal was, again, that Mr. Flack would renovate the property, he would manage the property, in exchange he would be given below market rental rates and a long-term lease. His agreement, Mr. Flack's agreement to renovate the property, his agreement to manage the property, all of that was outside of the lease agreements. So the damages that flow from the lease termination, the wrongful lease termination, are those lost profits that he would have enjoyed had he been able to sublease the property at what the evidence showed would be about a 4x of his rental rate. The damages that flow from the fraud, which are the disgorgement damages and the unjust enrichment, those damages are what NBSP is now going to get to enjoy because Mr. Flack improved their building. They don't have a corrugated metal shed anymore. Now they have a commercial ready 6,000 square foot building, which by the way, the replacement tenant is paying $10,000 a month in rent when Circle F's was $3,100 a month.
Did the contract have a Mother Hubbard clause? I mean, does it preclude any outside agreements to be considered?
I don't know the answer to that question. But I do know that the causes of action and the harm are separate, and that follows the case law. If you look at the one satisfaction rule, which I think, Judge Kelly, your question speaks to, NBSP relies on LJ Charter. I think that reliance is misplaced. In their brief, they say that the LJ Charter Court found that awarding the plaintiff in that case, its lost profits plus the profits that were earned by its competitor, was an impermissible double recovery. Mm-hmm. That's not what the court said in that case. The court said that awarding those damages twice for the same injury under separate theories was a double recovery. If you read on in the opinion, the LJ Charter Court actually allowed the plaintiff to recover for both breach of contract and unjust enrichment as a measure of damages for the fraud. So they allowed the plaintiff to recover its lost profits under the contract and the competitor's profits as unjust enrichment. So they did not allow for the same damages for different claims, but they did allow for different damages for different claims, which is what we have here. Does that answer your question?
It does.
I'm not here to give a speech. I have my notebook, but I'm happy to either answer any additional questions.
Well, I'll indulge you.
Certainly.
So regarding your lost furniture profits, you've told us about your profit per square foot calculation, but some of that from the record, it appears, was based on online sales, which mm-hmm. doesn't seem like it would include the same kind of expenses as a showroom, so as a physical store. So does the record explain how square footage of an online shop was calculated? How did that fit into the equation?
So what Mr. Flack did, and by the way, Mr. Flack was designated as an expert in the furniture industry. He has 30 years of experience. The family business, which was named after his mother, Diane Flack, they had furniture stores in San Antonio and San Marcos. Mr. Flack was integral in operating those furniture stores. What he did was take the previous 3 years of income prior to this transaction, and that it's important to remember that he took the net income from his tax returns. So there are objective facts, figures, and data that take expenses into account. I can do nothing but concede, I guess, that online furniture sales would have less overhead costs than store sales. That only accounted for a fraction of the financial data that Mr. Flack relied on. He was also cross-examined on that point. And the jury did not award that full measure of damage. Well, actually, they awarded us more. Sorry, I misspoke. They didn't award the full measure of damages on the lost profits from the subleases. So I think that Mr. Flack's calculation was complete. The appellant did not criticize his methodology at trial. They don't criticize it here. Appellant did designate an expert to opine, an accountant, to opine on the profitability of Mr. Flack's enterprise. She disagreed as to the amount of profitability, but did agree that the Diane Flack furniture business was profitable. And I would point out that the Diane Flack furniture business was the online business as well as those storefronts. And as the court knows, what the case law says is that the enterprise that you consider is the business, the type of business, and the people that, that run it, in particular when you're looking at whether or not lost profits are speculative for some kind of untested enterprise. So I think that the online sales were relevant in that calculation.
What specifically was Mr. Ray's fraud?
Okay, Mr. Ray's fraud, in addition to being, I guess, the front person for NBSP.
And did you plead alter ego?
We didn't. I don't believe we did, no. But Mr. Ray represented that NBSP would complete the parking lot in 30 days in order to induce Mr. Flack to remain in the deal, as he testified at trial, and to continue to put his money into renovating their property. Mr. Ray also made false representations to the bank. Mr. Ray also participated
what?
In the I'm sorry?
What specifically did okay. he make false representations
Mr. Ray,
to the bank, and how does his representations to the bank create representations to your
certainly.
Clients?
Because those representations, well, actually, maybe they weren't, those representations maybe weren't false. The representations that were made to my client were. So 8 months into this, or 11 months into this project, NBSP, even though Circle F's construction on the back property was not complete, NBSP presented my client with an invoice for 8 months of back rent, when the lease clearly said that rent was not due until that construction was complete. Mr. Ray participated in that representation. At the same time, we put evidence on at trial.
Where is that in the record?
Oh gosh, I don't have a specific site for you, but it's in our brief.
Okay.
At the same time, Mr. Ray and NBSP were representing to their bank that these clients of mine did not owe any rent to NBSP. So the false representation at that point was that we owed rent when we did not.
And all this is post-execution of a contract? All these statements that Mr. Ray made were post-execution of a contract?
They were, other than his participation in coming up with the inception of the deal, the royal deal of us coming in, fixing up the property, in exchange getting a long-term lease.
Was that the amended contract that had the fix-up of the property? Was that from the initial contract?
Neither lease included any obligation for Circle F or ODFI to improve the property whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So that side deal, if you will, was outside of the scope of the lease. That's one of the justifications for the separate damages for fraud and unjust enrichment.
So an oral contract?
I guess you could call it that.
I'd like to ask a follow-up question to what Chief Justice Byrne asked Mr. Morris earlier about the disgorgement issue. How do you justify the post-jury verdict disgorgement issue that was brought up and it wasn't pled?
So we did not plead the specific word disgorgement, but we did plead unjust enrichment and and fraud. And disgorgement is a type of damage that's available for fraud and unjust enrichment. We're a notice pleading state. I think the plaintiff was on notice that we would be seeking any profits that NBSP would be enjoying because of the improvements that we made to the property. We argued that to the jury. The jury heard evidence of the leases that NBSP has in place now after having evicted us, many of which are $20 more per foot than what we were paying. So I'll acknowledge that we didn't say the word disgorgement in our petition, but we did put plaintiff on notice, plenty of notice under the standards and Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, that we would be seeking those damages.
I acknowledge you've got a little bit of time left, and I'd love it if you'd just be able to wrap up what you're seeking from this court and any other last comments
sure.
that you'd like to make.
We are seeking, most importantly, we're asking the court to affirm the award of the jury and the judgment of the trial court. As I started out saying
and
earlier.
How do you get over the one satisfaction rule if you're asking us to affirm the jury's award?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the question.
The one satisfaction rule related to lost profits plus unjust enrichment and fraud damages. How do you get past the one satisfaction? So
we cite several cases. As I pointed out earlier, the case relied on by the appellant, LJ Charter, doesn't say what they say it says. We cite several cases, the McLeod case from Eastland, 644 Southwest 3rd, 792. The McCullough case, 435 Southwest 3rd, 871. And the Premier Pools case, which is an unpublished opinion from Dallas, 2016, Westlaw, 425-8830. And what those cases say, I've got a few quotes, but unjust enrichment is a form of restitution that focuses on disgorging the benefits it would be unjust for the defendant to retain, rather than compensating the plaintiff for the damages that the plaintiff suffered. That's from the McLeod case. Chief Justice Bailey wrote that opinion in 2022, and he allowed, in that case, for recovery of breach of contract and disgorgement via unjust enrichment when there were agreements and conduct outside of the contract at issue in the breach. In the McCullough case, the court allowed a client who sued an attorney to recover the amount of a contingent fee for the breach of contract and disgorgement of the amount of the fee from the attorney. In Premier Pools, the court allowed the plaintiff to recover its lost profits as well as the defendant's lost profits via disgorgement and unjust enrichment. So in that case was a trademark infringement case. So Premier Pools, there was another Premier Pools. They gave the plaintiff in that case an affirmative award of the plaintiff's lost profits for business they lost and the defendant's profits that they gained, presumably from customers that would have otherwise gone to the holder of the trademark.
Do you believe that this law is limited to trademark infringement and fiduciary cases and not an arm's length case, as you've got two really smart business people here and they're not fiduciaries of each other?
I do not, Judge. And that's shown, the Premier Pools opinion doesn't limit that holding to just trademark infringement. The instructive cases, some of them involve fiduciary relationships, but they likewise don't limit that theory. And there's one quote from Premier Pools that I think is important. Lost profits are compensatory and are awarded to restore the plaintiff to its position ex ante. Disgorgement of profits is intended to eliminate unjust enrichment to the defendant by directing it to the plaintiff. These are separate harms. The damages are intended to address separate conduct, separate harm. They don't violate the one satisfaction rule.
Thank you.
If I may, I have one last quote.
Please, I interrupted you, so yes, sir.
This is a quote I'd like to close with from the Southwest Battery Corp versus Owen case. This is a 1938 Texas Supreme Court case that is sort of the progenitor to a lot of our lost profits cases in particular. It is impossible to announce with exact certainty any rule measuring the profits for loss for which recovery may be had. A party who breaks his contract cannot escape liability because it is impossible to state or prove a perfect measure of damages. That's all I have unless the court has any more questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
And Mr. Morris, to wrap up, sir.
Most of this panel, I think, heard the case of Quantum versus St. David's Hospital not too long ago. I think you guys just rendered opinion here in the beginning of February. Mm-hmm. That case, the litigants were at least smart enough to come to the court and say, we're not asking both for breach of contract and civil conspiracy based on tortious fraud. They did the hard work for you. The mistake Mr. Flack's making is he's getting too greedy. He wants all of the awards, all of the money, all of the justification. And just like in Quantum, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Of course, the attorney fee award has to go away if the breach of contract goes away. But let's talk about fraudulent inducement for just a second. If you look at tab 5, in the exhibits, you'll see that there was a letter sent to Mr. Flack. Now, I need to apologize. On my piece of paper introducing it and on the table of contents, I've got it labeled December 28th. It's actually January 28th. It's clearly at the top of the letter, so I apologize for
that. And isn't there an objection to that tab?
This was part of our summary judgment evidence, and they objected to the summary judgment evidence. It contained some conversation about what a settlement would look like, and so the judge wouldn't let us bring it in until the second part of the trial, when they were there to discuss the punitive damages associated with fraud. And when the jury finally got to see this, and it became part of the record, they awarded $1 for punitive damages, because suddenly they heard the rest of the story. That is the moment in time when Mr. Flack, in January of 2019, had the ability to say, I've invested $240,000 in this building, and all I have to do is pay 1 month's rent, and I can open the doors and start business. And everybody at New Braunfels Stewardship wanted that to happen so badly. No one wanted to take his $240,000. No one wanted to take his money or benefit from it or have to rent it themselves. But he chose, Mr. Flack, chose to say no. I'm not going to take advantage of the money I've spent in this building. I'm going to turn around and file a lawsuit against you for wrongful eviction and get more money than I would have ever gotten if I had actually stayed and worked that property for 20 years. $1.4 million than the top dollar he would have ever gotten. So that's our first problem with unjust enrichment. Keep in mind, though, that the unjust enrichment that he's complaining of is part of a contract. Paragraph 34 in both of the leases talks about the tenant improvement dollars. Now, their argument is, wait a minute, we didn't have to improve those properties, but yes, he did. Look at the use provision in each of the leases. The back building says, will be used as a commercial furniture store, office space, retail. That's not what the building was. The building was dirt floors, metal walls, birds in the rafters. And he was obligated to then move it to the use that he agreed to in the lease. He had that obligation. That was part of the lease, which means any claim he has for that $240,000 falls under the terms of the contract of the lease. Both the initial lease in November 2017 and the amended lease in August of 2018, in which New Braunfels Stewardship said, we told you we'd give you $25,000 to improve the back building. We're going to raise that up to $75,000, we'll take some money off the improvements of the front building, but we want you to get open everything they could to benefit him for that unjust enrichment claim.
So, Mr. Morris, is it your position for the $240,000, there should have been some type of breach of contract argument made by the plaintiffs, maybe a repudiation by your client or something in order to assert and recover under paragraph 34 of the contract and not under the theory of unjust enrichment?
My position is that their claim for unjust enrichment is exclusive of a breach of contract claim because the breach of contract damages include the
$240,000. I got it. Okay.
They're the same claim, so it's subsumed into that. We were trying to figure out that $600,000 difference between the $1.4 million they asked for in the back building and the $2 million that they were actually granted. That's called guessing at the jury room. That's trying to guess at how they refigured these calculations. Not permissible in order to be able to do it. They had no evidence upon which to base a $2 million judgment, and the case law is pretty clear. The judgment award has to be within the range requested, and it wasn't. It was $600,000 more than the range requested. So there's no evidence of that. Just went back and looked at Papa John's letter of intent. Just to confirm, it was $26, not $28. I can point to you it in the record, but it's three places in the brief. There's this question about fraud and all these other fraudulent claims that are listed on, I think, page 67 of their brief. Yeah, page 67 of the brief, bunch of bullet points. Those aren't in the record. They're not cited to in the record. They're not for the court's consideration, and the reason they didn't cite to him in the record is because if you look at all those, they are contradicted severely and nobody had any plausibility of claiming those were going to be fraud claims until the jury came back with this massive fraud award, and suddenly they had to come up with a laundry list. But that's why there's no cites to the record. It's not anything that they could have relied on. Both leases do have a merger clause.
Okay.
Justice Brennan? Real quick, the online sales issue. Online sales, obviously, that was their, they mentioned it was fractional, just a part of what they were asking for the damage model for the back building. But the online sales was their best year. They cherry-picked that year because it was the best year of sales they had. And it was the years while they were building this building to move into and not be online anymore. That's fabulous, but it has nothing to do with their previous sales in San Marcos, which, by the way, he admitted on the stand. Remember, he had a tornado that tore up his building in San Marcos, and that's why they had to switch from San Marcos to these online sales. The proceeds of that settlement and the net carryover loss created these profits, and the CPA testified there's where a lot of the profits came from, these carryover losses and profits from the sales, not so much of furniture, but from an insurance settlement. So even that questions how much we can rely on any of those numbers coming in. Did Mr. Ray commit fraud? Take a look at tab 7. It's the conversation. You can see all of that conversation is the members of New Braunfels Stewardship, and the total contribution by Mr. Rusty Ray is, yeah, yep, that's my understanding, yep, that's what we should do. That's the fraud. If you look at what Mr. Hickman says, he's much more clear. We're going to have a gentleman's agreement. It's going to be $5,000 a month. But if you look at what Mr. Flack says, okay, fine, this will be a side agreement. This is part of what we're doing to build the back building and get it certified for the certificate of occupancy. That was the point at which they needed to stop. I just want to mention, just in passing, you'd mentioned keeping the summary judgments and keeping the ruling on the summary judgments. I have to tell you, it's like trying a case like this. Every time you have a summary judgment and a ruling that you can't stop, you can't talk about that. It's a motion in limine. It's everything that you want to do, but you can't talk about it. There was never need for that ruling. We only had to present half of our case because the summary judgment kept everything we wanted out. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the briefing and the oral argument presentation. This case will be submitted. And Westlake High School, feel free to stick around. We'll be right back out in just a moment to visit with you. And we'll allow the parties to go about their day. This case is submitted. Thank you very much. Court will stand in recess.
All rise.